All right, 2 Samuel chapter 14, if you would, please. 2 Samuel chapter 14. For the benefit of those who have not been with us along, I'll just briefly say that we've been working our way through 1 and now 2 Samuel and looking at the beginning of the monarchies in Israel, Saul the first king, and then David the king after God's own heart. We've come all the way up through, of course, chapter 11 and 12. It's the story of David's sin with Bathsheba. And then chapter 12, David's confronted by Nathan the prophet, "Thou art the man." And he's told that he's going to pay fourfold for his crime. The first payment was that the baby died. The second payment was that this situation that happened in his house, Amnon and Tamar, and Amnon was killed by his brother Absalom. Amnon had a fleshly desire towards his half-sister and forced himself upon her. And then David didn't discipline him. So Absalom decided, all right, fine, if he won't, I will. And so now you've got a household where one brother has killed another brother because the other brother raped his sister and dad hasn't done anything about any of it. Okay, at least from the kid's perspective. And from the biblical perspective, David didn't do much. And so that's kind of where we are in the life of David. His house is a mess, okay? And it is a lot his own doing. So we looked at Absalom's murder of Amnon last week in the second half of chapter 13 and just looked at the fact that David's response to that whole scenario was fatal. Because he did nothing, he caused the death of Amnon. And he should have dealt with it. The end of chapter 13, the last couple of verses, verse 37 through 39, says, "Absalom fled, went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day." Now, mourn for his son was probably not mourning for Absalom here. He was mourning for Amnon. "So Absalom fled, went to Geshur, and was there 3 years, and the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead." All right, that brings us into chapter 14. We're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 14 this morning, and our title is simply this: Is Your Field on Fire? Let's begin reading verse number 1. "Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was towards Absalom. So, and Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched thence a wise woman and said unto her, I pray thee, feign thyself to be a mourner and put on now mourning apparel and anoint thyself with oil, but be as a woman that had a long time mourned for the dead. And come to the king and speak on this manner unto him." So Joab put words in her mouth. Okay? That's the key here to a lot of what's going to go on in this chapter. That phrase right there, even Joab put the words in her mouth, is key when we get to the end when Joab's field's on fire. Okay? We see here, first of all, in these first couple of verses, Joab's plan. And it'll be expanded all the way down through the first half of the chapter. But verse 39 of chapter 13 says, "The soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom." There was a certain fatherly desire from David towards Absalom. Okay? But it was moderate. How do I know that? Because of the lengths that Joab had to go to get him to bring Absalom back. Okay? If David was just to the point where it's like, I got to see my son and I can't stand it anymore, he would have just sent him and brought him back. He's the king. I mean, that's what he did. He brought him back and nobody touched him because he was the king's son. If David was just to that point where he wanted his son back that badly, he could have done it. He was the king. Okay? So there was a certain sense where he was comforted with the grief of Amnon. And in a certain sense, now he is grieving as a father over Absalom. But Absalom's been in Geshur 3 years. You notice there was no messenger from David to Absalom, and probably rightly so. Okay, but it's also important to notice that there was no messenger from Absalom back to David. Okay, if Absalom was repentant, if Absalom wanted restoration, he could have at any time gotten a hold of a messenger and said, "Here, would you take this message to Israel and ask them to deliver it to my father, the king?" If he had sent any sort of a message of apology or any sort of seeking to initiate the process of reconciliation, things could, might possibly have been different. Absalom was a proud man. Absalom was hardened in his sin, and he never, ever made that effort. Okay? Even when he was finally restored to David, the only real scenario that you had there was that Absalom was trying to get politically back in the good graces so he could undermine his dad, which is what he did. Okay? But Absalom has not made any attempt to try to reconcile. And Joab sees what's going on. Now, it's interesting here. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived the king's heart toward Absalom. Okay? So, Joab could read people pretty well. He could see what was going on. He could see the, I think he could see the conflict in David. As a father, he was grieved over Absalom. He would love to have that restored. But he also could see that David wasn't really ready for the whole face-to-face reconciliation thing either. If David was ready for that, all Joab would have had to say was, hey, you want me to go get Absalom? Yeah, go get him. And it's done. But Joab has to contrive this fancy scenario to try to force something to happen. Okay? Why would Joab want to force something to happen? Right, we can speculate some reasons. He was family. And the fact that there's strife and conflict in the family and he'd like to see it resolved, I mean, that is a noble intention. Joab wasn't always a man of noble intentions, though. Joab's interest was Joab and Joab's power. And you remember we said that Amnon was the firstborn. And then there was another son that's mentioned in 2 Samuel chapter 3. That one time he's never mentioned again, so he must have died young. Which means that Absalom is the next oldest son, and he's in line to be king. So, you know, if Joab's doing the calculations here, and he's seen, he's observed Absalom growing up, he knows his character and his temperament and so forth, he knows that if David dies, Absalom's not just going to be content to stay in Geshur, he's coming back, and he's putting himself in position to be the next king. So, he could have been trying to save some strife for Israel because he was a statesman. For all of his other poor qualities, I think he did have a desire for Israel and what he perceived to be the best interest of the country. Okay? And it could have been for that. It could also be that he had killed Abner and he knew he was on the hook for that. But if he can get in the good graces of Absalom and Absalom becomes the next king, he may get out of punishment for that. This can be, there's a lot of things going on here. Okay, there's some politicking, there's some maneuvering, and Joab's trying to force something to happen that really shouldn't have happened. I mean, David wasn't ready for it, Absalom wasn't ready for it. The best thing in the world that could have happened was Absalom would have stayed away, or David would have sent to punish him. But nonetheless, Joab's trying to bring about reconciliation here. And he finds this woman of Tekoa. Now, where in the world is Tekoa? It's a little town. It's about 5 miles from Bethlehem. About 5 miles south of Bethlehem. Why is that significant? Okay. Where did David grow up? Bethlehem. Okay. Where did Joab grow up? In that same Bethlehem neighborhood. Okay. They're cousins. They grew up in the same area. And so this was somebody from Joab and David's home area. You know, I just happen to wonder, and this is maybe a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I just happen to wonder if this lady was a little bit of a local legend. You know, she was a wise woman, and maybe Joab had heard about her. Maybe he had heard her in person. Maybe he had heard about her through family. But he knew when he needed somebody for a specific task, right, this is who I'm going to call. And he sent and called this wise woman from Tekoa and said, here's what I want you to do. And he gives a scenario. All right, so now let's read the scenario. Verse 4. When the woman of Tekoa spake to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and did obeisance and said, help, O king. Is that, now, what kind of people are we dealing with here? We're dealing with Jewish people. We've mentioned this from time to time, and I don't want to stereotype, but at the same time, we need to understand we're talking about Eastern people who are much more emotional than our typical reserved Westerners, you know. And David was a very hot-blooded man. Absalom's a hot-blooded man. And this wouldn't have been, help, O king. I mean, she was mourning. Help, O king! All right? She's begging, all right? She's mourning, and she's pleading for the king to help. The king said unto her, "What aileth thee? What's wrong with you?" And she answered, "I am indeed a widow woman. My husband is dead. And thy handmaid had two sons, and they strove together in the field, and there was none to part them, but the one smote the other and slew him. And behold, the whole family is risen against thine handmaid, and they said, 'Deliver him that smote thy brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew. And we will destroy the heir also, and so they shall quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth.' And the king said unto the woman, 'Go to thine house, and I will give charge concerning thee.' And the woman of Tekoa said unto the king, 'My lord, O king, the iniquity be on me and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless.' And the king said, 'Whosoever saith aught unto thee, bring him to me, and he shall not touch thee any more.' Then said she, 'I pray thee, let the king remember the Lord thy God, that thou wouldest not suffer the revengers of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son.' And he said, 'As the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth.'" Okay? She has a heart-wrenching story. Okay? This is election season. Okay? One of the politicians' favorite tricks is to trot out some heart-wrenching story to try to make you think that they're your savior and their opponent wants to wipe out every one of us. Right? That's basically what this lady's doing, because this isn't a true story. It's a made-up story to try to make Joab's point. Okay? This is all under Joab's plan. It's the widow's parable, but it's really Joab's parable. And then it's Joab's plea. Okay? This is the widow's parable, but it's crafted by Joab to try to make another point. Okay? Her story is a heart-wrenching story, but I want us to understand when we go through this, it's primarily based on an emotional appeal. And there's some truth in it, but it's not, you know, a theological treatise. Okay? It's more of an emotional appeal here. And she said, "Look, my two sons were fighting in the field, and the one killed the other one." Okay? We heard that story before. Well, Cain and Abel, you know, Cain rose up and slew. But the two brothers were fighting in the field, and one killed the other. Now, the rest of the family wants to kill the murderer as judgment. And in some cases, that would have been a righteous desire. You know, well, this is justice. But you know, a lot of times when the family got involved, it wasn't because they wanted to see justice, because they wanted the property. You get, Pastor just mentioned that, was it Sunday? About how, you know, how families often, you know, the fangs come out and the claws come out when inheritances come out. And, you know, many times that was the case. They weren't interested in, quote unquote, justice. They were interested in getting their hands on the property and the inheritance and so forth. And now this woman is defending her son, trying to save his life. At least that's the story that she's telling. And her plea is, "I've got one coal left. And if you put that coal out, I got no more fire. I have one son, and if my other son is put to death, then our family name is put out." I mean, that's serious. Even today, while things are not, you know, quite the same as far as their land inheritance and so forth, that's a serious matter. None of us wants to see our family name discontinued. And that's the scenario she presents to the king. The king said, "I'll give charge concerning you." He said, "All right, I'll take care of it. Your son won't die." And she continues to press him. This is where she begins to demonstrate her skill as a wise woman. Because she has to not only have a script in her mind, but she has to be able to adapt on the fly and in response to what the king says. Okay? Her goal is not just to get the king to say, "All right, your son's not going to be put to death." She's trying to press to make a further point. And to do that, then there's a little bit of back and forth. He said, "All right, fine, I'll give charge concerning you." And she said, "Let the iniquity be on me and on my father's house." She's saying, if there's any guilt for not imposing the death penalty, for not following the letter of the law, let that be on me and not on the king. And the king goes further. "Whosoever saith aught unto thee, bring him to me. So first he said, all right, just go and I'll give command. And he said, all right, fine. I'll handle this personally if you bring it to me. And then she says, let the king remember the Lord thy God, that thou wouldest not suffer the revengers of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. Now David, as the king, as the civil judge, has the authority to say what he says. As the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth. All right? As a civil judge and as the king, the absolute ruler, he had the authority to say that. But this is why I say this is not a theological dissertation here. All right? Her theology is a little bit flawed right here. Okay? The cities of refuge and the revengers of blood. Okay? The city of refuge was for somebody that killed intentionally or accidentally. Right, accidentally. This was not an accident. The scenario she's presented was not an accidental thing. This was, he got mad and he killed it. Okay? And so, whether he went to a city of refuge or not, under the letter of the law, the revengers of blood still had the right to put him to death for this. But she's trying to say now, you know, God would let him live. And, you know, it's easy. People do that all the time. Try to twist the scripture a little bit to make it make a point that they want it to make. I'm sure you've never done that, but you know people that have, right? And that's what she's doing here, is twisting it a little bit and said, you know, don't let the revengers of blood. And David said, all right, fine. I'm going to spare his life. He won't die. You'll have your son. You'll have your heir. Okay? David thinks he's done. And yet, she continues on. Verse 12, the woman said, let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak one word unto my lord the king. Now, he said, say on, and then she starts into this thought. You see, the word one is added for understanding. You know, we could say, let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak a word. In other words, I got one more thing I want to tell you. And but let me speak one word unto the Lord the king. And he said, say on. And the woman said, wherefore then hast thou thought such a thing against the people of God? For the king does speak this thing as one that is faulty, guilty, is what that word means, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished. That's pretty bold. For we must needs die, and there is water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God respect any person, yet doth he devise means that his banished be not expelled from him. Now therefore that I am come to speak of this thing unto my lord the king, it is because the people have made me afraid. And thy handmaid said, I will now speak unto the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his handmaid. For the king will hear to deliver his handmaid out of the hand of the man that would destroy me and my son together out of the inheritance of God. Then thine handmaid said, the word of my lord the king shall now be comfortable. For as an angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and bad. Therefore the Lord thy God will be with thee. I hope you can see what's going on here. Okay? She sets out then to try to make her point. She's very bold speaking to a king to do this. And then she backs off and tries to end with flattery so that the king will be okay with it. Alright? And she makes her real point, and then she backs off and tries to tie it to me and my son, and then says that the king is an angel of God to discern good and bad, therefore God will be with thee. You know, She switches into pious flattery mode, and David sees right through it. But here, this is her real point. Her real desire is to try to press the king on this matter of his son. Well, that's a dangerous statement she made there in verse 13. The king does speak this thing as one which is faulty. You walk up to the king, put your finger in his face, and say, King, you're wrong here. What are the chances you walk out with your head still attached to your body? Okay? Depending on what kind of mood he's in that day, that may or may not happen. And she put her finger in his face, figuratively speaking, and said, you're wrong, you're guilty in this instance. Now, the king wasn't really wrong. But you see what's going on here. There's a group of people in Israel who would love to see Absalom pursued to the four corners of the earth and dragged out, hung. And there's another group of people that would love to see Absalom brought back. Okay? Well, I understand what he did. Look what happened to his sister. He was just avenging the family honor. If it had happened to my family, I'd have done the same thing. And you got these different factions and people with their own ideas. and we're talking about people's ideas instead of talking about what saith the Lord. And so then you get these different competing factions and people trying to get the king to go their direction. Chances are that this wasn't the first time Joab had brought this issue up to David. Okay? Joab probably mentioned it before. And maybe how he perceived his heart towards Absalom was that David didn't just snap and bite his head off. He was a little more receptive. But I don't think Joab's going to start like this. I mean, that wasn't Joab's normal method. He was not afraid to say what was on his mind. And so I think Joab's been on kind of on this side, and it's been brought up before, and now it finally comes to this point. But you see here that the woman mentions in verses 14 and 15, I'm come to speak this thing to my lord the king. It's because the people have made me afraid. I'm afraid of what people are going to do if you don't do this. Okay, pitting one group against the other. But verse 14, we must needs die and are as water spilt on the ground which cannot be gathered up again. Here is a pretty picturesque description of the brevity of life. James says, what is her life? Is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. And here she says, look, our life is just like water being spilled out on the ground that once it's spilled, you can't gather it back up and put it back in the cup again. So look, life's too short for this kind of stuff. That's her argument. Now, is that a biblical argument? No. Okay? Biblically, thou shalt not kill. Okay? And the Old Testament law further spelled out that if a brother lie in wait and kill his brother because of hatred, it specifically says you'll put him to death, thine eye shall not pity. If he goes to the city of refuge, it doesn't matter. That is spelled out very, very clearly in the Old Testament law. Absalom laid a trap for 2 years. He bided his time, he bit his tongue, he laid his trap, and then he sprung his trap. There was no description of Absalom's crime other than premeditation. I mean, nothing else is suitable. This was premeditated first-degree murder in our terminology. Okay? And so, she's making an emotional appeal with a little bit of truth, you know, bundled in with a whole lot of untruth or misapplication, and trying to make, to get the king to do what Joab wants done, what she wants him to do. I mean, this happens in our day. I mean, this isn't anything new either. I mean, it happens all the time. People say things that sound really good, and it is our job to develop a biblical filter, a sieve, if you want to use that. You know, like you sift flour. You pour it in the sieve, and you either crank the wheel or you shake it back and forth. And the sieve, the grid, is God's Word, God's truth, and the principles of Scripture. And we let the principles of Scripture sort what is flour and what is chaff. And that's what's necessary in our day. It's what's always been necessary, and that's what was necessary right here. And she's got some good points, some not so good points, and it's all jumbled together. We've got to separate this thing out here. But she's pushing the king, and then she resorts back to flattery. The king's an angel of God. He knows everything. Okay? Beware when men speak well of you in that kind of, in that overbearing, flattery kind of way. Okay? When that happens, okay, it's usually to distract from the other hand. When they pat you on the back with this hand, it's to distract from this hand that's got the knife. Okay? And she's using flattery to try to get what she wants. Verse number 18. The king answered and said unto the woman, hide not from me, I pray thee, the thing that I shall ask. And the woman said, let my lord the king now speak. And the king said, is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this? That right there is why I say this wasn't the first time Joab's brought this up. Okay? Why would the king immediately suspect Joab? Okay? Because Joab's pushed him on this before and he's resisted Joab. Okay? And so now Joab's trying a different method. But that, you see, David sees through part of it. He said, all right, now, tell me straight. Did Joab put you up to this? Did you ever do that to your siblings? Go ask mom and dad. We can have a brownie. Okay? And they walk in there. Mama says, I told you not to come in here and ask that. Did Tim tell you to come in here and ask? You know, And mom, dad, they can see through that kind of stuff. Well, that's what's going on here. David sees right through it. And he says, all right, tell me the truth. Did Joab put you up to this? Now, again, she demonstrates herself to be a wise woman in her response. Look at verse 19 again. The king said, is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this? And the woman answered and said, as thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right hand or to the left from aught that my lord the king hath spoken. Okay? That's a flowery way of saying you're dead on. You're not all, you didn't miss to the right, you didn't miss to the left, you're dead center. And for thy servant Joab bade me, and he put all these words in the mouth of thine handmaid, to fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing, and my lord is wise, according to the wisdom of an angel of God, to know all things that are in the earth. Okay, when it comes right down to it, she sold out Joab to save herself. Okay? That's what happened. Yeah, it's Joab. And if you don't like it, it was his idea. I kid like that sometimes, and somebody asks me, well, why do we do this? I'm like, it depends. If you like it, it was my idea. If you don't, it was his. You know? But that's kind of what's going on here. She said, in a very flowery, wise way, you're exactly right. You're dead on target. This was Joab's idea. Now, when people would come in front of the king, it would be in the king's court. Okay? Who else was present in the king's court? The king's officers, his sons, the princes, and his wise men, his counselors. Everybody may not have been there all the time, but I guarantee you that if he had any opportunity at all, Joab was there this day. He was in his normal spot, or maybe he was just standing over in the corner trying to act like he wasn't interested and really listening to what's going on. And Joab is paying real close attention to what's going on here. And so now, you got the king dealing with the lady, and then we get the spotlight right here on Joab. Now, what's the king going to do with Joab? So we've got Joab's plan, the widow's parable, which is really Joab's parable, and then the widow's plea, which is really Joab's plea. And now we got David's response, which we got Joab's plan, and now we've got Absalom's punishment, or if you want to say it this way, David's partial pardon. All right, now let's read it, and I'll explain what I mean. The king said unto Joab, behold now, I have done this thing. Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom again. Okay? So now, you got this everybody hold their breath moment. What is going to happen with David and Joab? David turns to Joab and he said, all right, when he said, I have done this thing, we might say, all right, done. Go. Okay? We would communicate that way sometimes. At least some people would. He said, I've done it. It's done. It's a done deal. You can go get him. I've done this thing. Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom again. And Joab fell to the ground on his face and bowed himself and thanked the king. And Joab said, today thy servant knoweth that I have found grace in thy sight, my lord, O king, in that the king hath fulfilled the request of his servant. This is a little bit of unusual flattery from Joab too, don't you think? Or maybe this is part of the custom of the king's court and all this kind of stuff. But to me, this just seems a little gushy for Joab too. We don't hear him speaking this way a whole lot. Maybe he did, and it's just not recorded in Scripture. But nonetheless, Joab said, today I know I have found grace in thy sight. Okay? That's the public thing that's going on. What's the private thing that's going on behind the scenes? David killed Uriah to cover up his affair with Bathsheba, and he used Joab to help him do it. When Joab found out what was going on, he covered it up publicly, but now he's got leverage on David. Joab, in essence, is playing some of that leverage that he's got over David. And, you know, that's part of the behind-the-scenes back and forth that's going on here. And he said, you go bring the young man. So now, Absalom becomes the good guy, right? He goes to, Joab, said the wrong name. Joab becomes a good guy. He goes down to Geshur, and he finds Absalom, and he said, look, here's what I did, and here's what I told him, and I finally got your dad to see the light. He said to bring you back. And all the way back, they're talking, and Joab's pumping himself up about how he's the good guy, and you know, how much Absalom ought to appreciate what he's done for him, and all that kind of stuff. And so they come back, and Absalom thinks, all right, this is great. I got what I want from David, and I'm positioning myself with Absalom, so if Absalom becomes the next king, I'm in pretty good shape here. Things are going perfectly according to plan. Then what happened? Verse 23, Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. Verse 24, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face. The word turn there, let him turn, literally means to turn around, or sometimes to go out and around. But the way that it's phrased, this is really what I think happened. You know, Absalom and Joab come back. Joab escorts him to the palace. He says, all right, let me go in and let David know we're here, and, you know, we'll arrange a meeting with you and your dad. So he goes in, or the messenger comes to announce the arrival, and David says, let him turn around to his own house, and let him see not my face. So Absalom gets up to the door, and his dad says, uh-uh, you tell him to turn around and go home, I don't want to see him. Okay? Bam! And you got to spank it. Okay? That's why I say it was Absalom's punishment. It may be partly for punishment that David would make him kind of be in limbo for a while. I mean, if people hear, all right, Absalom came back and he's back in Jerusalem, they're going to assume, all right, David's okay with everything, right? And so if they hear, all right, Absalom came back, but David won't see him. He's in his own house. And in some ways, he's almost under house arrest, or he's confined in some way. Then this is a form of punishment. That may not have been a bad idea. That's why I said it could be Absalom's punishment, but it also is indicative of David's partial pardon. That is, David agreed, all right, go get him, bring him back, but he wasn't wholeheartedly ready for this thing. I mean, now, what are the other pressures that are going on here? I mean, the other wives are saying, you're not bringing him back, so you're going to kill my son next? Okay? He's got Solomon, and he's thinking, man, if I bring him back, Solomon, the Lord called him Jedidiah, whom the Lord loves. Is he going to find that out? Is he going to try to take out Solomon as soon as I say Solomon's going to be the next king? I mean, there's lots of things going on here. Not only that, I mean, he's guilty of murder. He's guilty of treason against the king. And there's lots of factors in this whole deal. And yet, so David agreed to bring him back, but for whatever reason, he's changed his mind. And he's only going to go part way. So let him go to his own house. All right? Verse 25. Almost a little parenthetical thing here. But in all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot, even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. I mean, there are people making millions of dollars selling products that they tell you will get rid of blemishes. Right? Get rid of wrinkles and get rid of bumps and get rid of discolorations. And, you know, give you the skin of a five-year-old and all this kind of stuff. Well, Absalom had it. Perfect complexion. Perfect figure. Perfect hair. I mean, you want a model, it was Absalom. Verse 26, and when he polled his head, for it was at every year's end that he polled it, because the hair was heavy on him, therefore he polled it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels after the king's weight. The word polled literally means to be bald, or to shave bald. So he shaved his head. Okay? So that's what the Hebrew word means. Where in the world did we get the word poll? Okay? Maybe you don't wonder that kind of stuff, but I do. Okay? How in the world, where did this come from? So I looked it up. Webster's 1828 dictionary. The word poll means the crown, the pate, or the head of a person. I mean, those are some synonyms, but the definition is the head of a person or the back part of the head. That's what the old English word poll meant. Okay, our modern day usage of we're going to the poll is where you count votes came from kind of the idea of taking a head count. When we have votes, we're going to count heads and see who's for this guy and who's for this guy. That's where our, you know, we think poll, that's where you go to vote, that's where votes are counted and so forth. But he polled his head. He shaved his head and it weighed 200 shekels. Okay, best I can come up with, that's 6 pounds. Like, oh yeah, no big deal. Really? Go over here to Ingles after church, grab a 5-pound bag of sugar, and then figure out how much hair it takes to be the same weight. That's a lot of hair. Okay? We talk about Esau, Edom, being hairy. I mean, this guy had a foot in a competition, that's for sure. But he says it was 200 shekels after the king's weight. It works out to 5 or 6 pounds. And Absalom, unto Absalom there were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of a fair countenance. Again, it ran in the family. The good looks ran in this particular family. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. Now, why do we have that little parenthetical? It's because those are the things that other people looked at. They were impressed with his good looks and with his beautiful family and, you know, with how much hair he had. You know, you think, oh, that's so trivial. Yeah. Go look at Twitter and see what the trending topics are and tell me that's matters of significance. Give me a break. I mean, people are absorbed with the trivial. That's the whole essence of social media. And so these are the things that people locked on. Boy, he's such a handsome fella. He's such a nice guy. He's so sweet when he talks to me. I don't know why all these people have something against Absalom. He's a nice guy. And for 2 years, that's kind of the feeling that's going on. But David, for 2 years, refused to see Absalom. Verse 29. So we've got Absalom's punishment or David's partial pardon. Now beginning verse 29, we see Absalom's petulance or pride. Petulance is a bratty little kid. Okay, and that's how he acts here. Therefore, Absalom sent to Joab to have sent him unto the king, but he would not come unto him. All right. Now, again, this is a political game. Joab's the savior. He brings him back. But now, Joab won't return his phone calls. He won't return his messages. Because David's still not ready for this thing. And so now he's more leaning towards the David side of things. And he sent to Joab. Joab wouldn't answer. Therefore, Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again the second time, he would not come. Verse 30. Therefore, he said unto his servant, see, Joab's field is near mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. All right, for you college guys, let me just insert a little parenthetical here. This was sin. Okay, this isn't a biblical justification for going and doing that this afternoon. Okay, just what I need to throw that in there. Verse 31, then Joab arose and came to Absalom unto his house and said unto him, wherefore have thy servant set my field on fire? Verse 32, and Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent unto thee, saying, come hither, that I may send thee to the king to say, wherefore am I come from Geshur? It would have been good for me to have been there still. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. Okay? You got, two proud guys going at it here. Joab said, what are you doing? You set my field on fire. And he said, you didn't return my messages, so I had to find some way to get your attention. And I wanted you to come send to the king. You wouldn't do it. So now, I got you here. See, next time, return my messages. Okay? That's what's going on here. And so, sure enough, verse 33, so Joab came to the king. Okay? So, Absalom used his little manipulative brat techniques, and he got what he wanted. He got Joab to go and talk to the king. Joab came to the king and told him. And when he had called for Absalom, he being David, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. That's David's pardon. Okay? So where do you see that? Okay? David received Absalom. He kissed him as a friend, as a son, and he was formally received back into fellowship. Okay? As in a civil sense, David was the judge, but he was also the king, and he was also dad. And in all three of those capacities, he received him back. As the king, as a citizen, as his dad, he received his son, and by kissing him there, he demonstrated, all right, everything's okay, this is my son, and there's not going to be any further follow-up on this situation. That was David's pardon. But let's go all the way back to the beginning. Joab was trying to force something, okay? And he thought he had a great plan and it didn't work. So when Joab's field is on fire, was it Absalom's fault? Yeah, but it was also Joab's fault, okay? He was monkeying with things. But the point I want to close with is this. I said my title this morning is Your Field on Fire? What does it take to get your attention? What will it take for God to get my attention? What will it take for God to get your attention? Let me give you some examples from the Scripture. Moses, God had met him at the burning bush and said, I want you to go back to Israel, to Egypt and bring my people Israel out. And then the Lord met him by the way and was going to slay him because of the circumcision of his sons. He refused to do that. So his wife, they end up circumcising the sons and, angered his wife over it. But it took an angel of God getting ready to kill Moses before he would finally be obedient in that circumstance. Balaam, it took a talking donkey and an angel with a sword in his hand to get his attention because he wouldn't listen any other way. Jacob, You know, when he was wrestling with the messenger of God, it took his hip being put out of joint before he would finally listen. When the children of Israel murmured and complained, and God said, all right, fine, you're not going in. They said, oh yeah, we are. Numbers 14 says they went presumptuously up into the hill and attacked the Amalekites, and they got destroyed. It took loss in battle and loss of life to get their attention. Saul, it took him to the point of having his skirt cut off in the cave and then having his spear and cruse of water stolen in the middle of the night before he would finally say, all right, David, you're right and I'm wrong. But he didn't really change. But, I mean, it took dramatic events to get their attention. Same thing here with Joab. His field had to be put on fire before God could get his attention. If I can say it this way, God knows how to get my attention, and God knows how to get your attention. Okay? Now, God doesn't start that way. God starts with the still small voice. He starts with the kindness of providence. He starts with parents or friends or authority people in our life that will speak to us and in some cases correct us. And the more we just ignore those things and blow right through it, the pressure has to be ramped up and ramped up and ramped up. This is a great illustration of Psalm 32. Psalm 32, verse 8, 9, and 10 says this, I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. Be ye not as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle, lest they come near unto thee. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked, but he that trusteth in the Lord, mercy shall compass him about. The horse and the mule, you have bit and bridle, you have pressure and you have pain, and that's what it takes to get their attention. But here, the psalmist said, don't be like that, just listen. But if we refuse to listen, God knows how to bring the pressure, the pain, and if necessary, the field on fire to get our attention. Okay? I don't want to be there. You don't want to be there. It's far better for us to listen at the beginning of the process and never have to get that far. God knocking on your door? Then let's be sure to listen.